Welcome to Cattlecast.
I'm Mary Guida, managing editor for 517 Magazine, and I'm excited to guest host this special episode. More women are holding seats on corporate boards, running their own businesses, and of course, serving in prominent roles of federal, state, and local government. So with these advances, has the glass ceiling finally been shattered? Joining me to discuss this important topic are State Representative Sarah Anthony of the 68th House District and principal and producer for Render Studios, Karen Steffel, who is also co-host of the Speakeasy podcast. Sarah and Karen, welcome to Cattlecast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for listeners who aren't aware of the term glass ceiling, which was first referenced in a 1979 Wall Street Journal story about two women at Hewlett-Packard who were frustrated by their lack of advancement opportunities, can you articulate in your own words what the glass ceiling is?
Sure, I can start. This is Sarah. I would say it's a glass ceiling because you can't always see it, but you know it's there. It's, you know, all of the barriers that are in front of women that result from years of explicit and implicit bias and discrimination on the basis of sex in the workplace primarily. You know, we know about all of these contributing factors such as pay inequities and you know, inequities in lending and home ownership and college admissions and stereotypes. All of these things contribute to there being this element, this ceiling that prevents women, regardless of how qualified they show up in the workplace, from actually reaching the highest heights in boardrooms and in workplaces across the state, across the country.
And Karen, what does it mean to you?
Well, it is that invisible barrier, and it prevents upward mobility, and it prevents women from achieving those top jobs that they aspire toward. And really, in every industry, you're looking at not only inequity, but there's just a lack of parity. For example, in my line of work, you know, I'm a producer and director, and it's my opinion that the stories that we tell ought to reflect the fabric of our society. And when you don't have the right people at the table who are telling those stories, you just have a misaligned representation of what our society looks like.
Absolutely. In Hillary Rodham Clinton's November 2016 concession speech to Donald J. Trump, she closed with, "I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now." Now, flash forward to January 2021, the inauguration of Kamala Harris, the first female, first Black American, and the first South Asian American ever to be elected Vice President of the United States. Is this indicative of the glass ceiling having finally been shattered? And why or why not?
You know, for me, as an African-American woman in politics, it was definitely one of the best moments professionally that I've ever experienced. To see a woman that looks like me, that has a similar experience, who belongs to the same sorority, reach that office, there's nothing that can describe it. But it is one crack in the ceiling, but the ceiling is still there. And I think that folks forget that Kamala's journey was a very tough one. We forget that, you know, she, in many of our views, including myself, I was rooting for her to be our commander in chief. I believe that she was qualified to be president on day one. And instead, America was just not ready to elect her as the president. It was, you know, now President Biden that selected her to be his running mate. And so, even throughout her journey, you saw extreme racism and sexism. So of course, she's paving the way for many other women leaders. But when I asked my nieces, you know, about that journey, about going into public service, they think about all of the attacks. They think about the hyper-focus on her attire, the rumors about how she got to the positions that she had, and all of the questioning about whether she was qualified enough. So of course, we have hope that more women leaders will, you know, go into public service, but we can't divorce ourselves from the fact that her journey as a woman and as a woman of color just looked fundamentally different. And we as a country still has not reached the point that we are comfortable being led by a woman or a woman of color in the highest office. I hope we're getting there. I hope we're inching towards that. But I think that how divided our politics are and how sexism still creeps its ugly head into all aspects of life, it tells me we still have a ways to go.
Right. Karen?
I agree with you completely. And I think when you were talking about her hard journey, of course, that what primarily is conjured in my mind is race. A woman of color having a position of power, that had to have been an incredibly hard journey. But I think about less the glass ceiling being broken and more about those broken or missing rungs on the way up. And it's those broken or missing rungs as women get passed over to become a manager, get passed over to be a vice president, get passed over because they took time off to have a child or for whatever other reason, that that's the reason why our ceiling hasn't been shattered, really.
So however you can describe it, and without naming any names, any people or organizations, can both of you describe an event during your career journey where you faced a barrier that precluded your ability to advance and rise up to your full potential? And then if you can also share how you responded to it and maybe how that's impacted you today.
It's funny because I have been in this industry for 22 years in Michigan State. I was only one of two women in my program, because women just weren't going into technology related fields. And I only had one female professor the entire time in my field. And where we're standing now is we're just now having women finish college who had STEAM educations their entire educational journey. And so they're just now being able to afford the opportunity to become the mentors of the next generation. So that being said, when I step on set, or when I was very young in my career, when I would step on set, whether I was, a grip, I was doing the heavy lifting, or whether I took off my tool belt and was the director, there was assumption if I stepped on set and people didn't know me, somebody from the facility might direct me to where the makeup crew was setting up because I was a woman, or assumptions in meetings that I was somebody's assistant. But because there just weren't women, little 5 feet tall, spunky women in my field at all who were in charge. I'm very lucky. I had an incredible, an unbelievable example in my mother, who was both a professor and a small business owner. So I wasn't ever afraid to speak up for myself. But the assumption based on me just stepping on set that I couldn't be the person in charge, it actually ignited a fire in me more than felt. It for sure felt like a barrier, but it ignited a fire in me more than anything.
Mm-hmm. That's powerful. For me, I experience these kind of barriers and really inequities all the time, right? It's a point of pride to be the first Black woman to serve Lansing as state representative. But it also brings challenges, right? There are so many times when stakeholders, maybe well-intentioned, will ask if we should give a piece of legislation to one of my white male counterparts to make sure it gets across the finish line, right? Questioning my ability to get things done. Although I've just proven time and time again to be a pretty effective lawmaker, belittling my credibility and lowered expectations. And some of these things are just blatantly just dripping with sexism and racism. Even when it comes to a part of politics is raising money. And when I pull, reports about what some of my white male counterparts bring in the interest groups, they may cut them a $5,000 check and they'll throw $250 at me and say, don't spend it all at once, right? And I think that, some of it is, not being invited to, have drinks or smoke a cigar after work, and which we know in my field, that's where many of the deals get done. And so obviously no one is preventing me from serving as a legislator. The voters have decided that I'm qualified enough to be in that position. But you know, oftentimes I lift up the voice of one of my just sheroes, Shirley Chisholm, who talked about having a seat at the table. And what I am starting to realize is that even when, you know, women earn that seat, right, become, you know, a part of a board or a group or, you know, obtain a legislative office, what usually happens is that they just create another table and one that is even harder to get on. And so I say all that to say how I've been able to navigate it is just working harder, is just calling it out when I see it, holding people accountable for bias and bigotry, and ultimately working every day to show up as my authentic self, which is one that includes my experiences as a woman. And I think that the people who elected me wanted me to bring the voices and the experiences of aunts and mothers and daughters to the table, even if I have to shove my way into the next table, the next room, in order to make sure that their voices are heard.
Well said. So what evidence today is there that the glass ceiling still exists? We still have work to do. For example, in 2020, there were 37 female chief executive offers leading Fortune 500 companies. That's the highest ever, but still only 7.4% of the total list.
Yeah, and even smaller percentage of those 37, I think only 2 or 3 are women of color. And so that really just is the example. That's your answer. There's just advancing women in their careers so that there's parity and equity. It's just, we're still talking about it. And that's the evidence enough, for me at least. You know, I mentioned that my mom was one of my greatest example makers. She was both entrepreneur and professor. And Jimmy Carter actually invited her to sit on a small committee for women in small business to satisfy the curiosity of like, well, how do you do that? And I mean, it's certainly gotten a lot better because we all know women in business, especially small business, but it almost makes me wonder why? Why are there so many women deciding to become entrepreneurs? Is it because they're deciding to circumvent the barriers that they've already been faced? Or is it because that's actually what they sought out to do? And that's anecdotal, of course, but you know, as Sarah mentioned, she just decided she needed to work harder. And I think that a lot of women end up taking that road, that if somebody else is going to put a barrier in front of me to go around it, I have to chart my own course.
Another example, in January this year, CNN Business reported that despite women holding more jobs than men in the U.S. economy, at least for 3 whole months, they earned an average only 81 cents for every dollar that their male peers earned.
That's right. I mean, this week, I'll be reintroducing a pay equity resolution. Now, before I became a state rep, I was a lowly staffer. And my boss, former Representative Joan Bauer, introduced the same legislation to help to address pay equity in the state of Michigan. You know, the proof is in the pudding, right? I mean, obviously, like, some folks will never change the hearts and minds of individuals, but I want to make sure that women are making what they need to provide for families, right? And we saw this with the COVID-19 pandemic. I think even here in Michigan, labor force participation fell 6% during the pandemic compared to 1% for men. You know, it shows that lots of the industries that women are overrepresented were hit disproportionately harder. And we also see, you know, large gaps in women in elected office. I mean, you think about of 100 of the, you know, of our country's 100 largest cities, only, you know, about 73 of them are led by men. And even in Congress, I think about a quarter of congressional seats are made up of women, but that's obviously not enough. And we talk a lot about, you know, numbers and women being represented, but I think that we sometimes shy away from why it's important. And the fact that women have these unique experiences that are reflected of, you know, all the experiences that are, you know, hitting women and children and families, right? Education, workforce, environmental justice. We talk about childcare. There are some very kitchen table issues that women are so well positioned to to actually elevate when they are in these positions. So it's not just about the existence of women and checking the numbers and checking the blocks. Women bring so much in terms of elevating these issues to the workplace. And I think it's just important to just to note that.
A McKinsey and Company report entitled Women in the Workplace 2020 indicated that at the beginning of 2020, before the COVID-19 pandemic began here in the US, the representation of women in corporate America was on the right track. It was trending in the right direction. Between 2015 and 2020, the share of women grew from 23 to 28% in senior vice president roles and from 17 to 21% in the C-suite. Women remained dramatically underrepresented, particularly women of color, but the numbers were slowly improving. And then, as you mentioned, COVID-19 hit, and as many as 2 million women are considering a leave of absence, leaving the workforce altogether. The first time signs of women leaving the workforce at higher rates than men, which had previously been fairly even. Fewer women in the workforce means fewer women in leadership, as we've been talking about, far fewer women on track to be future leaders. So what do both of you think this means for corporate America?
It means we have a lot of work to continue to do to overcome. I mean, our whole world has a lot of work to do to overcome what's happened over the last year with the pandemic, but we have more work to do. And we need to challenge the assumptions about why are the women leaving the workforce? And it's because if you are in, a differently gendered relationship, it's highly likely that the woman earns less than the man, or it's because if there are children at home needing schooling, often the nurturing person is more often the woman. There's so many sex and gender-based issues kind of loading this question, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Karen is spot on. And I think, 2020 was a year in which we all took pause and took stock and started to have some difficult conversations, primarily about race. But I think that corporate America needs to do some soul searching around a lot of issues, around issues of race and equality, and also sex and discrimination, and how we cannot just, put together these perfectly curated statements about how Black Lives Matter and how we empower women and we put women on the brochures to make sure that it looks like we're inclusive. Like, corporate America needs to do the real work. They need to unearth these systems that have been designed to leave certain populations out, and then specifically and strategically and intentionally bring women into those C-suite positions. It will not happen by happenstance or by accident. It will have to be by design. Structural and systemic inequalities and racism and sexism happens because it's a system. They were designed to be discriminatory and biased. And so I think for corporate America and all industries, they have to take a systemic approach to dismantling it and then building it back better in a way that empowers women and people of color.
Right. And with white males continuing to hold the majority of America's top jobs, what role do they have to play to support or advance workplace equity as it relates to the removal of barriers, invisible or otherwise, that hold women and minorities back?
Well, I think as Sarah was just saying, it's going to take corporate leadership, who are often led by men in many more times than women. But I think men being allies is an absolutely important part of the diversity puzzle. And it can either be very threatening or very scary to be a man, to promote a woman, and to be a mentor or a sponsor for that woman, because it might then get in the way of you helping out one of your buddies that, as Sarah insinuated, that they go out and have a cigar and have a drink and, or play golf with. But I think it really comes down to corporate leadership. As Sarah was saying, we're already seeing some corporations leading things like fair minimum wages or living wages, but it has to extend, and that's going to help a whole lot of women, but it's also got to extend beyond that for, again, mending those broken rungs on the ladder and making sure that people can persist. But I think it also requires some policy. I think it may require some policies that kind of watch the corporations who are maybe not being as equitable.
That's right. Yeah, that's spot on. I mean, I think, you know, there's tangible things that folks in leadership can do, right? Rethinking and diversifying the pool of where opportunities are promoted and advertised, right? We all get into our own bubbles, but how can you diversify where opportunities are going? Also rethinking what leadership qualifications look like, right? Thinking about job descriptions and, you know, and empowering women to think about leadership differently. You know, I talk to women all the time who, when I'm trying to convince them to run for office or apply for a C-suite position, they say, oh, I don't think I have the leadership qualifications. And I say, wait a minute, you've got three kids, you're a single mother, you are balancing, you know, and managing a budget, you are the best task manager that I could ever think of, and you don't think you can actually lead? Like, there are ways that I think we need to rethink these qualifications and empower women to shoot their shot. And also organizations can do more to make their workplaces more family friendly. You know, expanding childcare options, improving social services for working families, make the workplace just better and more suitable, and also obviously expand opportunities to non-traditional candidates.
And that leads into, you know, women maybe not having that confidence. You've heard the phrase, women can sometimes be their worst enemy. If, in your opinion, this is true, what ways would you say women hurt their cause for advancement and their growth opportunities? How do we do a better job of helping ourselves and other aspiring females and minority professionals to reach for that next rung on that corporate ladder?
I think mentorship in the workplace is something that could continue to be expanded. And it's not just, oh, checking a box because a program exists to sponsor women and help elevate them in the workplace. I do not believe I am one of the women who makes other women feel like they're not being welcomed. You know, I'm very intentional about who I spend time with, or who I have job shadow, or who I sit down and coach, or who I share my entrepreneurial experience with. So I want to make sure that I'm giving those opportunities and giving those attagirls as much as I can. But I do think that mentorship in the workplaces has to be incredibly intentional, whether that's on the small business side or the corporate side. But I also think that we have to create entrepreneurial pathways for women, so that, because we know absolutely that it's harder to raise capital, as Sarah noticed with her own fundraising experience, but it's harder to raise capital for a woman because some things are just less accessible. So we have to create those entrepreneurial pathways. And we know that from the percentages that it's not, we have a lot to chip away for college access, but we know that more women are going to college than men. We know more women are getting their master's degree than men. And we know that more women are graduating than men, but yet we cannot pass through that barrier, again, those missing rungs. And so it has to be done in the workplace.
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, because Karen just said it all, said everything I was going to say. But the other thing—
I know you're the college access expert.
Well, the other thing I would just say, in addition to the mentorship piece, is, and this is something that I think is maybe like a little dirty little secret amongst like women in the workplace, is this scarcity mentality. The fact that oftentimes when we see other women across the boardroom, sometimes they're looked at as competition because there's just so few women. And my perspective has always been, we all can eat. We all can do better. We can lift each other up as we climb. And I think that it is, you know, the old, you know, crabs in a barrel mentality. And I see it in workplaces, you know, all across the region and across the state. But if we kind of pooled our resources, mentored each other, and lifted each other up in the workplace, I think we would get to the point that we would be able to like lift as we climb, and not see other women in the workplace as competition, but rather as sisters that we can, you know, all do better and echo each other and uplift each other when, you know, both of our voices are being muted and not being taken seriously. We obviously do better when we're just stronger together. So I think making sure that women aren't seeing themselves as competition in the workplace will obviously help us all aspire and be better.
Now, knowing what you know today and all your acquired wisdom over your years of experience in the workforce, what advice would you give your younger self and all of America's future female and minority leaders as it relates to shattering that hardest and highest glass ceiling?
You know, it's funny. I have mentioned my mom a couple times, but I remember one of the nicest compliments somebody ever paid my mother to me indirectly was that she was both woman and lady. And of course, this is forever ago, many decades ago, but I felt like that was so profound, and I've carried that with me, that early in my career, I found it very hard to lead men who are older than me, not necessarily men who are my peers, but just men that were older than me, because they frankly didn't like taking direction from me, and that made it challenging. And I think it's, I was afraid to be too direct. I was afraid to hurt feelings. And it's not that I'm not afraid now, but I feel like one's years of experience and one's professionalism and being able to demonstrate that you're an expert in your field should not be threatening, and that there are ways to navigate difficult conversations that that allow you not only to rise, but expand.
So one of the things I just absolutely love to do is talk to young women, right? Young women that are in high school or college. And I'm seeing a trend of younger women, I don't say dwelling, but a question that constantly comes up is, how am I able to navigate sexism in the workplace and racism in the workplace and all the isms? Like, how did I, you know, survive these, you know, toxic work environments and the oppression? And I don't know if that's a good thing. If women are almost becoming armed with, you know, ready for battle when they are going into the workplace. Obviously, I've always been conscious that these, you know, glass ceilings and barriers are there, but I just don't dwell on them. I try to find ways to navigate and work around and through, and, you know, when I can, try to dismantle along the way. But I just have found that if I spent every waking moment, you know, disarming and thinking about all the ways that people see me, all the ways that I have to tackle these big issues, I just wouldn't get a lot done. And I think that I hope that women, particularly younger women, are showing up into spaces as their full selves. And yes, being conscious of these barriers, but not allowing it to consume them. Because there's so much greatness in all of us. And I'm sorry, but my white male counterparts don't have to do that. They don't have to show up into spaces and think about, you know, how they're dressed and their hair and, you know, do I look too sexy? Do I look too professional? Did I say that right? Do I need to, you know, talk about my credentials so that they take me seriously? I want to see a world in which women just show up and be their best and brightest selves. And that might be a utopia, but that's just what I'm looking forward to. And that's what I want to instill in my nieces who are, you know, now years away from being a part of the workforce.
I think it just really boils down to things you both have said, showing up, lifting each other up, and just keep on pushing through.
For sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Karen Steffel, Representative Sarah Anthony, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you. You guys are wonderful. Appreciate it.
If you are interested in learning more about this topic, there are some book links in the episode description. I'm Mary Guida. Thank you for listening to Cattlecast.
Don't miss another great interview. Subscribe to the Cattlecast podcast and share it with a friend.
Hey, it's Dee Dee in the Morning with Dee Dee's weekly download from Capital Area District Libraries. This week's title is More Than Enough, Claiming Space for Who You Are, No Matter What They Say, by Elaine Welteroth. The media trailblazer and former Teen Vogue editor inspires with her story of self-empowerment and breaking barriers. To download or stream this or other featured titles, visit cadl.org/Dee Dee.
Stacks 92.1.